The Guardian.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2013 with Claire Armitstead.
Last year's festival, we kicked off the 50th anniversary World Writers' Conference, which was a reprise of a very famous or infamous conference that happened way back in the day. And since then, it's been going round the world. And I've got with me three of the people who've been involved in it. I'm Nick Barley, Edinburgh Festival Director. You have travelled the globe this year, haven't you? I seem to get emails from different parts of the world every week.
It's been an amazing experience, but really it's been about enabling the authors to travel the globe, and we wanted to set up a conversation which was genuinely including authors from all over the world. So it did require us to travel, it wasn't simply a jolly. And it was extraordinary conversations in Congo, in Kuala Lumpur, in Trinidad and Tobago. And so I think we included the kinds of authors who don't normally get included in mainstream literary conversations.
Harry Kunzru, you're a writer. Are you the sort of writer who doesn't get included in mainstream conversations?
No, I think I'm quite lucky. I mean, firstly, I'm lucky in that I write in English. I mean, that's something that we need to say at the outset, is that there is this extraordinary Anglophone dominance of the idea of world literature. Indeed, I've just read a grumbly essay online by somebody saying that the whole idea of world literature is just a strange sort of cipher for a conversation that's being totally driven by English language work. And that's one of the interesting things about this conference, is that it actually has made the effort to reach out beyond that sort of sphere of world writers in English who might be familiar to book buying audiences in the UK and the US.
Susie Nicklin, you were the director of literature at the British Council, and it was very much your brainchild. You used the subject headings of the 50 years ago conference, and there were some grumbles early on that they were inappropriate today. For example, nationalism, censorship, subject headings that people weren't sure were relevant today.
I think that's been completely disproved, any of those rumblings, by exactly what happened around the world. And I think, as Harry says, if you listen, there's a fantastic sound installation here in Charlotte Square Gardens where you can actually hear some of the voices. And I mean, think of a country like South Africa or Malaysia. I mean, actually, the riffs on things like nationalism have been extraordinary. Think of what's going on literally today in Egypt. And I think that Adaf Swaif's speech about literature and politics proved to be literally contemporary.
You're going to be in a summary talk a bit later today, and the subject is fiction as tenacious as a cockroach.
Yes, I mean, I think ever since the novel sort of emerged in the 17th century, people have been declaring that it was almost dead, and it doesn't seem to ever die. And I think there are interesting reasons, firstly, to why you might be continually saying it was about to die and why it doesn't. I mean, people have a very powerful attachment to storytelling. So anyway, that's one of the things we will be discussing. I like the cockroach metaphor. I think that's very fruitful.
Nick, I've said you've been travelling the globe. Did you make any particular discoveries? Were there particular communities of writers in different countries that you didn't know about before?
I mean, I think one of the most interesting things for me is to have met up with writing communities all over the world, and particularly Francophone, German-speaking, other languages which don't necessarily get translated into English so easily. And I was particularly impressed in Brazzaville, in the Congo, at just how engaged the writing community in sub-Saharan Africa is, not only with the Francophone world, but also with the Anglophone world, an extraordinary wide-ranging knowledge of literary issues, and an amazingly powerful belief in the importance of literature to help them understand the changing post-colonial Africa. So really, above all, it was a sort of an understanding that everywhere around the world, literature, fiction, is important to help us understand anxious times.
Susie, where is this going to go next? Is this the end of an elegant year-long experiment, or do you think it's laid the ground for something more?
Well, it's being wrapped up pretty much in the rest of August in Melbourne for this stage. I think it's amazing how it's had this past life. I picked up a copy of The White Review the other day, number 7, and there was 3 references to this conference. I know that there are teachers here in Scotland who've been teaching some of the speeches from the conference. So I think, you know, it really is proving to have an afterlife.
Harry, have you discovered any particular writers during this year?
The bizarre thing for me is that I've been invited to speak at the conference, but because the American government impounded my passport as part of a green card application, I wasn't actually able to participate except online. But I've been following it from the internet, so to speak. And I have made a point this year of actually trying to read a lot of fiction in translation. And so I've been reading especially Spanish language and Norwegian writers, and both of those traditions seem incredibly vibrant to me at the moment.
Susie, we do, usually on this podcast, we interview English language writers, but that doesn't mean English or from the UK. Where would you say the big energy is?
There's a fantastic energy in Ireland at the moment. I think that's really, really noticeable. People like Con McCann on the long list for the Man Booker Prize, for example, with Transatlantic. It's a very interesting point that publishing is moving all its headquarters to the USA. I think there's some astonishing publishing coming out of North America at the moment.
I'm Marina Salandi-Brown, and I'm the director of the NGC Bocas Lit Fest, which is the annual literary festival in Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean. When we started the festival about 3 years ago, we had no idea that we could be part of a world discussion about literature. Being part of the Edinburgh World Writers Conference so early in our development meant that we were able to prove to the people in the region that other people were taking us seriously. And so we could actually use that to generate interest. So on one level, as far as sponsors and government support, etc., that was very, very strategically important to us. But quite apart from that, we've been trying to bring writers and readers together in the Caribbean in a way that hasn't been happening. And nobody realized there was a need to do that. And the response by everybody to the EWWC, the Edinburgh World Writers Conference, was extraordinary. We packed out the place, people came from other islands, and I'm told that the liveliest amount of tweeting and viral activity was from our festival, which shows that, you know, I mean, the Caribbean is huge. I mean, it's 1,000 miles between Jamaica and Trinidad and hundreds of miles in between, you know, left to right. And there isn't very much to hold us together now that our cricket team isn't doing so well. And so something like the Literary Festival is a way of bringing us together in a way that people had never imagined possible. And we had Jamaicans and we had Trinidadians and we had people from all the other islands taking part in that conference. We debated two subjects. And everybody felt that we should be very, very grateful to the organizers for inviting us to be part of it. It shows that we're a little bit grown up, even though we don't know we are.
What were the two subjects you debated?
We debated whether there's a national literature. And of course, in our terms, this is really about countries or islands. Jamaica, which has got a very, very strong cultural, well, it has exported a very strong culture. And Trinidad, which has also got a very, very strong culture, but hasn't been as successful as Jamaica in exporting it to Europe. And we are half the size of the population. So a national literature is very, very important. And also we have different ethnic groups. So what is a national literature to us? It had many, many kinds of connotations. And then the other thing that we discussed was, should literature be political? And of course, for us as emerging writers, although we've got two Nobel laureates, living Nobel laureates for English, for literature, and we have produced some wonderful writers, but people haven't really taken it on seriously. So to talk about whether there should be politics in literature was something that caused people to think. And I think that's what literature should do. It should cause people to think. So it did, and it was a great thing. So those were the two that we chose because we thought that they were more pertinent to where we are in our development, this project, the Bocas project.
I'm Sophie Cook. I'm a novelist, short story writer, poet, and travel writer.
And you have a particular experience of this World Writers Conference. You went to Beijing.
Mm-hmm. I was overwhelmed at first because it was so different to anything I'd experienced before. And I was overwhelmed in a good way. Like, I think I had imagined it would be a very oppressive place. I had read things here about, I guess, like human rights issues in China. And I had imagined this very oppressive state. And instead, I found this place where everyone could do what they liked. It seemed it felt very free on the surface.
But there was a bit of an incident, wasn't there?
I was invited to give the keynote speech at the Edinburgh World Writers' Conference on style versus content. And I had felt quite conflicted about being invited to a place that I knew had issues relating to freedom of speech and censorship, where I knew that there were imprisoned writers. Of course, as a writer, that makes me feel quite conflicted. At the same time, I think it's really important that the Literary Festival remains a place that's impartial, that's a place where views can be discussed. So this creates this really interesting dilemma, interesting in inverted commas, of how far can you push things? Because you want to maintain the ability of the festival to function. At the same time, the reason it's important for it to function is that it can contain contentious ideas. So it's a question of being able to talk about things, but without getting people who have to make their day-to-day living there into trouble, of being respectful as well for the culture in which, after all, you are a guest. That was part of it for me. So I wanted to recognise the issues without necessarily suggesting that I had an idea about what should be done, because I don't. I'm not an expert on China or Chinese issues, but at the same time, I feel I'm in a privileged position as a visiting writer. It's an arrestable offence in China to even say Liu Xiaobo's name. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong even. But it's arrestable in China to say his name. So I know I'm in a privileged position. Just being able to say, this person exists, here are some lines of poetry that he wrote, and knowing that I'm not going to probably be thrown into jail for saying that. So I felt it was important to do something, but not to endanger the existence of a place where people can talk.
What were the lines of poetry you read?
He's saying, I want to save you, even if you are dead or still barely breathing. And he's talking about the remembering of Tiananmen Square, which is something that you can't mention in China. In China, no one died in the Tiananmen Square massacre. That's the official version of events. It's really interesting because even Western publishers go along with this. So, for example, in the Lonely Planet guidebook for China, if you look up Tiananmen Square, you will read that there was a demonstration. You won't read anything about people dying. That's been edited out. It's something that Western publishers collude in because they have to sell the Lonely Planet guidebooks in China. So this isn't about saying one culture is bad and one culture is good. This is something that's to do with people shifting product sometimes. So I didn't obviously want to stand up in that hall and start mentioning Tiananmen Square. I didn't feel it was relevant. I didn't feel it was my place to do that. I did feel that it was relevant for me to mention the guy's name and to say that he's in prison and to read some lines of his poetry, which after all are very beautiful, and you can take them any way you like.
What was the reaction in the room when you read them?
Afterwards, the director of the festival said, did you notice the secret policeman running into the auditorium? And I hadn't, to be honest. What was lovely at the end of that was that a lot of the students were coming up to me and saying, can we have a copy of your speech? And I was naively saying, I'll email it to you. And they were like, no, give it to us so we can photocopy it. And when I'd finally understood why they were saying that, I turned around. By that point, my speech had disappeared off the podium. Of course, it's about the books, but I think it shouldn't be just about promoting a book. I hate this thing that's happened now in publishing where they talk about the title and it's product, it's become product. I really think a book contains its ideas, its emotions, its hopes, its love. And it's like, this is the thing that really we should be promoting rather than the title, the product. So if that's happening more elsewhere, I'm glad. I'm really, really happy. I think that should happen more.
Slightly surprising experience for a young Scottish writer there. We have the texts of many of the festival keynote speeches up on the Books website, so do take a look on theguardian.com/books. As Susie Nicklin said, English language literature embraces a whole variety of cultures. In Charlotte Mendelssohn's book a long-listed novel, Almost English, it extends to London's Hungarian community.
Thursday, 29th of December, 1988. They do not know it, but the wolf is already at the gate. 7 o'clock on a moonlit night at the end of December, a terrible time for a party, and the guests are about to arrive. After the complex agony of invitations, the expense, the whipping of cream, the residents of Flat 2, Westminster Court, are almost too tired to greet their visitors, yet there is still so much to be done. They have been up since 5 in a fury of efficiency, wiping the underside of ornaments, hoovering beneath the many rugs, rolling pastry, slicing cucumbers, innumerable tasks if this evening is to be perfect as it must be. And now, while Marina's grandmother and great-aunts rest on their beds, Marina and her mother stand in front of the wardrobe in Marina's little room, pretending not to panic. "Can't I just wear my school jumper?" asks Marina. "Lamb's wool's smart." "Maybe not enough, sweetheart," says Laura, her mother. "You know they hate..." "Never mind. What about that green dress?" "Grotesque," says Marina. "Where's your long skirt then? Oh, Lord, what does your grandmother say?" "I don't know," says Marina, ominously wet-eyed. "I look repulsive in everything. I..." "Darling," says a voice from the doorway. It is Marina's grandmother, not resting at all. Rosie, 80 today, and not a woman one disappoints. "What a pity you don't want to look pretty. Look, I have this." Marina turns round and sees the blouse Rosie is holding out to her, olive satin with a leaping gazelle motif. "I," she says, "I think..." "And Laura, darling," says Rosie, "tonight you also try." Laura's mother-in-law is not easy to ignore. One does not become a major figure in the world of ladies' underclothing if one is weak. Laura swallows. "Yes," she says, "of course I will." She frowns at herself in the wardrobe mirror, her wet hair, her fair, apologetic Midland skin. "Save me," she thinks as the liver-spotted arm withdraws. "Marina, love, your kilt." "I could," says Marina doubtfully. She lowers her voice. "Mum, I wondered, can we talk?" Usually this would make Laura's heart beat faster. However, she's less vigilant than usual, thinking of all that dill still to chop. "About what?" she says distractedly. "It's complicated. Darling," they hear again from the doorway. "Hurry, we have still to set out the serviette." "Coming," says Laura. "Sweetheart," she whispers to her daughter, "we'll talk later, I promise, okay?"
Charlotte, that scene gets the anxiety of being a teenager just so acutely, it sends goosebumps all over me.
Well, Marina is 16, nearly 17, and she just knows that everyone else knows how to be cool, how to be glamorous, how to be pretty, how to cope with boys and school and everything, just not her. And so I suppose, actually inadvertently, I sort of conveyed that all in those first two pages, in that she has no idea what to wear for her grandmother's birthday party. She knows she looks disgusting and everything, and she needs a solution, but there isn't one. She has no idea what to wear ever.
And don't you just know a boy is going to arrive?
A boy is going to arrive because a boy is exactly what will make this impossible situation even more difficult and untenable, partly because she can't really cope with boys at all, partly because immediately her great aunt will go, "Darling, who is the lovely boy?" And partly because the whole thing will just be excruciating and embarrassing and terrible. So yes, a boy has to arrive.
So this is called Almost English, and the great aunts and the granny are Hungarian. Why did you choose to set it among Hungarians?
Well, my own maternal grandparents were Hungarian speakers, although their actual nationality is a little bit more complicated than that and takes about half an hour even to explain. I loved my grandparents and I missed them, and I wanted to write about their world. In the end, I decided not the world that they'd come from in the old country. I wanted to write about what it's like for old immigrants who've been in, you know, my grandmother, 50 years after she moved to England, had such a strong accent that people would sort of give her directions to, you know, bus stops and things. They couldn't believe she lived here. And I wanted to write about what it's like for them in London, but also, you know, that universal experience of the second and third generation immigrants, where, you know, everyone at home is foreign and it's terribly embarrassing. And I've had a lot of incredibly positive responses from people who have Greek families or Italian families, or Catholics seem to like it a lot. Because, you know, we all know what it's like having families that make us not fit in. It's just, you know, what food they have in the fridge that differs from family to family.
The Hungarian you use, and you actually do write some Hungarian in it, is very comic. Would your grandparents approve of that?
They would be horrified, but actually they would also be incredibly amused, because they agreed that Hungarian is a hilarious language. It's full of the most extraordinary words, like, for example, happy birthday is boldog szulotésnap, or potato is crumply. None of the words sound even vaguely sensible.
Somebody said of your work that you deal with the private lives of children, but I think you also deal with mother-child relationships a lot.
I write about the private lives of families, as in what, whether it's grown-up children or parents or children. I love writing about families because they're such an incredibly claustrophobic environment. People think they know you incredibly well, but actually your inner world is maybe completely different to what they assume. So yes, private lives of children are completely fascinating, but so are their parents.
We're running this interview in the context of the Edinburgh World Writers Conference, which has been going around the world talking about how healthy the novel is. Do you feel that you have a readership? Do you feel hopeful about it?
Well, when I was growing up, novels were my world. And, you know, everything I am has come from reading. And I don't think that stops. You know, I think there will always be people who want to read enormous quantities. So I don't think the idea of the novel being healthy, I understand that, but it's not something that I worry about. I mean, we're obviously in an incredibly fruitful, amazing time for fiction all over the world. So people worry about publishing and ebooks and all of these things. But I think, you know, people always want stories, and it fulfills such a basic need that I think we'll be all right.
Your novels include, you've written about Jewishness, you've written about being a clever girl at Oxford, and now you're writing about your Hungarian roots. Do you feel that your fiction is sort of working out who you are?
The clever girl, she's a child at Oxford rather than a student. I'd never write about being a student because I just think students are incredibly boring on the whole. I suppose I am sort of mining, you know, the weirdness of growing up in Oxford, the weirdness of growing up with Hungarian grandparents, but it's all sort of outsiderishness, you know, and I have a theory that, you know, the vast majority of readers and the vast majority of writers all share the experience of outsiderishness, so we're just writing to each other and it all makes sense. We all know what we're talking about.
There are so many different cultures writing fiction in English at the moment. Where do you fit into that, and how important do you think those different voices are?
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, because I think, you know, I'm white. I have ridiculous posh pre-war BBC vowel sounds. You know, I pass for English, but I'm not, and I don't feel it because three of my grandparents weren't born here. So I wanted to write about, you know, almost Englishness, the experience of being sort of foreign, but apparently fitting in, because I think, you know, yes, there's lots of fiction about being very other in Britain, but actually there surely are an awful lot of people in Britain whose parents, grandparents are from somewhere else, and so their experience is slightly off-kilter as well. So it's a book about that sort of semi-Englishness.
The Books Podcast from Guardian.co.uk.